Hi, this is Joe Patty. Thanks for listening to WRTI Online. This service is made possible through the support of WRTI's members. You can become a member, too. Since you're already online, just visit www.wrti.org and click the Become a Member link on the upper left corner of the webpage. You can also join us by phone at 1-866-809-9784. Your membership will help keep WRTI's broadcast and online services strong. And again, thank you. Now, on with the show.
Our guest today is James Conlon, one of the most highly acclaimed conductors in the world. He returned to the United States after 20 years as principal conductor of the Paris Opera and many of the world's most prestigious orchestras to become music director of the Los Angeles Opera. Mr. Conlon is also music director of the Ravinia Festival, the summer home of the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, and has been music director of the Cincinnati May Festival since 1979. He was general music director of the City of Cologne, Germany, and music director of the Rotterdam Philharmonic. And since his New York Philharmonic debut in 1974, has appeared as guest conductor with virtually every major North American and European orchestra. Mr. Conlon received the Zemlinsky Prize for his efforts in bringing the composer's music to international attention in 1999. He has received many honors, awarded an honorary Doctor of Music degree from his alma mater, the Juilliard School, in May of 2004. He also will begin a two-year residency at the Juilliard, during which he will work with the school's young artists in a cross-genre educational project consisting of performances, symposia, masterclasses, and coaching. He was awarded France's highest distinction from the President of the French Republic, Jacques Chirac, the Légion d'honneur, in September of 2002. His newest project is an effort to raise public consciousness to the significance of works of composers whose lives and compositions were affected by the Holocaust. Most of them perished. Mr. Conlon has devoted himself to extensive programming of this music in North America and Europe. At both the Ravinia Festival and LA Opera, he continues to program works of these composers, and his residency at Juilliard will focus in part on the study and performance of the lesser-known works of these composers. This includes Alexander Zemlinsky, Victor Ullmann, Pavel Haas, Kurt Weill, Erich Wolfgang Korngold, Karl Amadeus Hartmann, Erwin Schulhoff, and Ernest Krennic. This afternoon on WRTI, we will hear a production of the Los Angeles Opera conducted by James Conlon, of Victor Ullmann's The Broken Jug and Alexander Zemlinsky's The Dwarf, based on a text by Oscar Wilde. After a small technical glitch, we were finally able to speak with Mr. Conlon.
Hello.
James Conlon? Maestro, hello. Jill Pasternak here at WRTI.
Nice to hear from you.
Sorry for the delay. There's always something the last minute.
There's no problem. I'm just waiting for you, so there's no problem.
Oh, that's great. I know you have a rehearsal, so I want to welcome you to Crossover. And your story is kind of the return of the native, isn't it? After how many years abroad, have you come back to the United States to settle?
Well, you know, conductors never settle anywhere completely. I'm, you know, as you know, I'm grew up in New York, and then I spent most of my conducting years traveling between the U.S. and Europe. About 20 of those years, I was based in Europe between, let's say, 1983 and 2004. And in the last few years, I have moved back to the United States, largely because I've got two daughters and my wife and I decided we wanted them in schools here. So, but I continue to conduct in Europe, and conductors are rarely only in one place.
Now, we've had many recordings that you've conducted here at the station, and I am a graduate of Juilliard myself, and I got the Juilliard Alumni Bulletin. This is about, some months ago, and I saw a headline there that you were coming back and you were going to be doing a residency there and a whole project. And, of course, it was interesting, but I must admit that it was your involvement with the
Forgotten Music. Well, we call it Recovered Voices.
Recovered Voices,
yeah,
yes.
Which is a large umbrella. I mean, we chose that term at Los Angeles Opera, even though I have a similar project with the Chicago Symphony at the Ravinia Festival, which we call Silence Voices. The title isn't quite as is not as important as is the subject, and the subject is about bringing to the public's attention, and not just the public, but to musicians in general, the enormous volume of works that have basically remained unplayed since the 1930s or 40s. Or if they have been played, they have been played in rare performances. And they have never been presented in committed performances over and over again over a period of time that it re-enters the repertory where it should be.
Well, of course, this is a mission. I guess you have really kind of become a crusader in a sense. I visited Terezín a few years ago. We went to Prague and went to Terezín and saw what was going on there, or at least, you know, the remnants of what had been going on there. And when I read about what you were doing, I could only, you know, remember that. It was a terribly, terribly emotional experience. And I wondered how you, in your quest to bring this music back to the public, have coped with that. Have you divorced yourself from what you're doing musically as opposed to what you're doing morally, I guess, in a sense?
Well, I don't see any divorce in it. I mean, I have a you know, a viewpoint that includes a moral position, a historical position, and an artistic vision of this whole period. And it's really not very difficult to. They're all complementary. I mean, there's a moral imperative about undoing injustice in any walk of life in which you happen to find it. And that goes beyond being an artist and a musician. The idea for me is that you cannot redress the injustices that were hoisted upon these composers during their lives.
Of course.
You can at least do the one thing that would mean anything more to them than anything else, and that is to see to it that the music is at least restored to the public's attention so that it can be heard and learned by younger generations. There's the historical perspective is that we, musicologists, students of music, the universities, have written the history of the 20th century with an enormous omission. And this omission, of course, is not the fault at all of the works in question, but the fault of a terrible time in history. So I think in both of these cases, they do not contradict each other. But none of this would matter if the music was not of an artistic quality that merited its inclusion in the repertory. And I think that last part is ultimately the most important. The composers, for the most part, these composers were all in, at least in the midst of the tradition which we have come to treasure as classical music tradition. There were some outsiders, many of them were struggling, but, you know, struggling composers were the rule, are the rule in history, not the exception. They were for the most part, and I think of people like Zemlinsky, like Schrecker, Schoenberg. They were intimates in the Vienna of Mahler. They interacted with one another. They all knew each other. They came right out of the center of musical activity in, let's say, Vienna, Berlin, Prague, the most important centers at that time in history. So we are not seeking to, you know, define compositions of any sort or any manner just to put them back in. We're talking about composers who represent an enormous piece of history. I think there's a mandate for any historian that if new information evolves or new information comes to light about any period in history or any aspect of our past history, we need to review it. We need to see again the time and context. So there are many reasons why I think that this is important.
Well, obviously you answered the question of the validity of the music, obviously. I know that Ullmann was a pupil of Schoenberg, wasn't he, at one point?
Victor Ullmann, whom you've seen Terezin.
Oh, my goodness.
In Terezin for 2 years and wrote 20 compositions, including an opera in Terezin.
Was that the Emperor of Atlantis?
And you the didn't, opera he wrote, it. There is the Emperor of Atlantis.
And you did that, didn't you, with the L.A.?
I have done it in many places. I had a production that was conceived and performed for the first time together with the Juilliard School in New York at Central Synagogue, and many people who were present at that performance asked me then if I would bring it, and that eventually traveled to many cities, to Spoleto, Italy, to Los Angeles, and performed with the Los Angeles Philharmonic. It went to Florida, where we performed it with the New World Symphony. It went to Chicago, where it was done in the Ravinia Festival. It's been to Houston. It's a production that has traveled a great deal since that time.
That's in German, is that right? It was written in German, I think.
It's written in German, of course.
Yes, and of course performed in German. Now, again, not to beat a dead horse, but you had to look toward Jewish philanthropists to support your efforts financially. Isn't that right? And on this project, is that correct?
Yes, it's partially correct. I mean, many of these projects, of course, have existed without philanthropy in that sense. I mean, for instance, as a guest conductor, I have brought a lot of this music to, practically all the American orchestras with whom I have performed, and many of the European ones. There's no question of philanthropy in those cases. They are, it's a part of a subscription series, it's a part of the regular series. But it's quite a different thing when you're talking about producing operas. Operas are very expensive. They have to be prepared years in advance. People can't take risks with budgets in the same way. So it's quite a different story. And here we are very fortunate in Los Angeles to have won the sponsorship of Marilyn Searing and the Searing Foundation, who started us off with a gift initially of more than $3 million. And of course, we are continuing in that tradition. We are very active in seeking funds to keep this going in the future years. And of course, we need to. So nothing is easy in today's world. But we think it's extremely important that this project continue on in into the coming years, so that what we have done is not tokenism or a tipping of the hat in a symbolic way. We want in a very real, practical way. We want these works out there and being heard.
Yes, that's wonderful that you do, but the world is a funny place, and I just wondered if you will be viewed as doing something special. You have already, clarified how you feel about the music, and it's a link in the 20th century music to the development of our musical heritage. But have you run into any other, I don't want to say obstacles, but do you encounter any attitude problems about the affiliation of the composers as artists, and their demise and so on?
Well, occasionally I run into people who simply don't like the subject, don't want to hear about the subject. I mean, I've been excoriated on neo-Nazi blogs.
I'm sure.
There are people who have a vested interest, or at least a prejudice, where they don't want to see this subject discussed. I have to say, though, that it is a very, very little. The reception and the enthusiastic reception, and mostly by audiences, I've encountered, far outweighs resistance. I can see it from the successes at the Ravinia Festival with the Chicago Symphony. Our board, our patrons, have asked me to make sure that I will continue it. I usually speak with briefly before concerts with the audience. In Los Angeles, there is no question. I would say that the first two projects, the one you're about to hear, of course, the double bill of The Broken Judge Goodbye, Victor Ullmann, for which this performance was, of course, the United States premiere, and The Dwarf of Zemlinsky, which is called Der Zwerg in German, emotional response of the public was so strong that it was clear that this had, first of all, I believe that the work will have this effect on anybody at any time, but I think the significance for us in L.A. Opera was extremely important because it was the proof that taking this artistic stand, and it is an artistic stand, was deeply appreciated. We've had two projects. We had we did a kind of an abstract theater concert performances in the previous year where I introduced the subject to our audiences, and it was the same result. I think what was moving to many people at the time was to see an audience in a standing ovation receive a work that they had, of which they had never heard a note. And you know, there's a great deal of talk, rightfully so, about our audiences tending to want to hear the same works over and over again, and that's fine. I mean, I want to hear Mozart over and over again. I want to hear Beethoven and Brahms over and over again. But I also want audiences to hear things that they have never heard. And I think this is a proof, again, that when people come and listen to something of great quality, and I believe these operas are of great quality, they will respond the same way they will respond to Wagner or Mozart or Verdi or any other composer with whom we are very familiar. And in, when it comes to operas like The Dwarf, I've seen this over and over again. Yeah. I produced it in Paris. It was sold out at every performance. It was such a success, we brought it back several years later. I've performed it in Italy. I, of course, as you know, recorded it in Germany almost 12 or 13 years ago. So I've seen it over and over again. So that's why I have full confidence in the strength of these works.
Where do you put them musically in terms of, you know, compare? Well, you're moving on to what? It's romantic. It's actually contemporary.
Well, it's very hard to put them in a category because I think what emerges is when you start to know the music of various composers, Zemlinsky, Schrager, Ullmann, Braunfels, Korngold, who comes under this heading, you will see that it was a time that was was richly varied, far more than we thought or we think. There were currents and cross currents and competition and changing. It is music you can describe in many different ways. There were very clearly post-romantics. Some of this music was extremely romantic. Some of it was avant-garde at the time. Some composers really went off on their own, in their own direction. We have tended to see the 20th century too schematically, as if there was a single line. Mm-hmm. And this, I think, comes from philosophical prejudices of the 20th century. I mean, part of it was political and economic. At least, Marxist theories was that there was a direction in history, and it was an inevitable direction, it was an inevitable end, and that revolution would bring this about. Well, I mean, now in the 21st century, we've seen that wasn't so, and yet a great deal of philosophical thought was deeply affected by that. It is a misapplication, in my opinion, when it comes to art. Equally misapplied was Darwin. Now, I'm a believer in Darwin, and I don't like seeing Darwin kicked around these days the way he is. But the Darwinian theories were misapplied to music. There is not necessarily a development in music that mirrors that which is in nature. It was just an assumption that it was so, that it becomes more complicated, the species become more complicated, the survival of the fittest. Well, you know, a lot of these composers, Zemlinsky, Schrager, Braunfels, didn't survive not because their music wasn't fit.
Obviously.
They didn't survive because of the Nazi political repression and genocide. So these are misapplications of admittedly important theories, but we've tended to view the 20th century as an inevitable movement toward the end of tonality. Let's put it that way.
Yes.
Now,
well,
I don't believe tonality died at all. If you will, it migrated to the popular world. It migrated, but it didn't die. And I think a lot of opportunities were lost for many decades. I now know that, of course, now it's being revisited. And I think one of the reasons that it took so many decades for anybody also to revisit the issue of these composers whose music was banned by the Nazis is because in many of the cases, they had not subscribed to either fully or partially to many of the orthodoxies of the time, post-Schoenberg. I mean, I'm a great lover and admirer of Arnold Schoenberg and a Berg and a Webern. So it is not. This is not meant to disparage them, but it is meant to disparage the orthodoxies that followed after their deaths. In other words, the years I'm thinking of, the 50s, I'm thinking of the 60s, where no other music except for electronic music was given any sort of recognition as having any validity. Mm-hmm. So naturally, at that time, you would not find anybody who was willing to go back into the 30s, into the 20s, and find a lot of tonal music, or at least if atonal, at least not serial music, go back to those times and say, oh, well, wait a minute, there's something here of value. Nobody was really willing to do it for any decade.
Well, it was the vogue, I think. But I think also you can't deny evolution in music, because I think art is like that. It builds upon the what's happened before. And certainly, you know, it's a moving and changing subject, but you are right there. It's what's in vogue at the time. And it is very, very political in terms not only of the government politics, but about the artistic politics. I think anyone in the art world is very, very aware of that. Would you program these in a regular operatic season?
That's what we do in Los Angeles.
Well, see, now I am assuming that this is a special project, but would you?
No.
This is what you do. You integrate this into your
absolutely,
program.
Absolutely, and
okay.
That's exactly where it should be. This should not be, if you would accept the term, it should not be like a ghetto. It's not.
Thank
this
you.
It's not something that is separate.
Okay.
This is something that is an integral part of that season. It's on our subscription series. It is not a special series. When I come to the Philadelphia Orchestra, as I often do, this coming fall, there will be Schrader and Zemlinsky on the program, and it will be shared with Beethoven.
Now, when will you be coming to Philadelphia?
That's sometime very early in November.
Well, then we'll have to see you when you come here and come to our station. It's been a delight speaking with you, Maestro. Thank you for taking the time, because I know you're really, really busy. But it's an exciting project. It's wonderful to hear you speak and to hear your thoughts generally. And we hope to have more of that here on WRTI. Thanks again.
You're very, very welcome.
Okay. Bye-bye.